Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to see you all back again today for the second day of the conference. I'm delighted to be able to introduce our keynote speaker this morning, Dr. Mark Morris. He's a historian, author, and broadcaster. He studied and taught history at the Universities of London and Oxford. In 2003, you may remember that he presented a highly acclaimed television series called Castle and wrote an accompanying book on the series. His book on the 13th century Earls of Norfolk was published in 2005. In 2008, he published the best-selling biography of Edward I. And when I say best-selling, it really is best-selling. I was listening to the sales figures last night. They're astonishing. And it was called A Great and Terrible King. His recent book, The Norman Conquest, was published in 2012. And he's currently working on a book on King John for 2015, which we'll look forward to. This morning, he's talking to us on the Norman Conquest. Why did it matter? Welcome, Mark.
Good morning. Can you all hear me? I'm using a radio mic rather than this. It's a real honour to be addressing the Historical Association Conference. I've never done anything quite so sort of important, I think. Seriously, and it's lovely to be in York. I haven't been here for a very long time since I was a student myself, so it's glorious weather. So I'm very, 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 very happy to be here this morning. Now, I know it's silly and dangerous and even infantilising, but we're going to start with a cartoon. Thank you. And the reason I start the talk and indeed the book with this particular cartoon is because you're instantly back in that world. There is no better source for transporting us back to the 11th century, even though we're over-familiar with it. It's beaten into us when we're little, and you see it at every English heritage gift shop, on a tea towel, keyring, mug, etc., mouse mat. But it's important just to sort of remind ourselves what a brilliant source this is. Because they're there, the Normans. For those of you perhaps who've just arrived by spaceship, I should say this is the Biotapestry. It's a frieze or a cartoon. It's about 50 centimetres wide, but nearly 70 metres long. And it depicts the key events leading up to the Battle of Hastings in 1066. And it was made within a year or two of the conquest itself, certainly within a decade. So it's a very, very closely contemporary source. And as I say, there they are, the Normans. As we all remember them, you know, with their pointy helmets, with the flat, fixed nasals, their mail shirts, hurling themselves fearlessly into battle. Elsewhere on the tapestry, we see the Normans setting fire to the homes of their enemies, building castles, burning castles, feasting, fighting, arguing. We'll get there. Killing and conquering. There's poor old King Harold getting an arrow in the eye. Or did he? I used to unpack this at the top of the talk. I started doing it to sixth formers a year or so ago, and I watched them, well-behaved as they were, falling like flies. So I've cut it, and it's at the end of the talk if you're interested. We'll do it in the questions at the end. Elsewhere on the tapestry, besides Harold, of course, we see his antagonist, Duke William of Normandy, later William the Conqueror. They're seen in his civvies, and he's got that distinctive haircut that we know about from the Bayeux tapestry. Hair shaved close up the back like his fellow Normans on the left. There's a sort of small, cowering Englishman in the middle of them who has the distinctive English moustache. So, and also on the tapestry, besides William, we see his notorious half-brother, Odo of Bayeux, seen there charging into battle at Hastings, even though he was a bishop. The reason it's important to mention Odo is because he was, I say almost certainly, as far as I'm concerned, he was the patron of the Bayeux tapestry. Lots of other less credible candidates have been proposed in the last couple of generations. Why do we think it's Odo? Well, obviously the tapestry is now in Bayeux, and we know it's been there since the late 15th century. It first appears in an inventory of 1476. He's the obvious link because he's Earl of Kent after the conquest. So he's the great man that links the place where the tapestry was made, which is Canterbury. We know that because at lots of stages, two dozen or more stages, you can see the tapestry artist borrowing images copied from Canterbury Christchurch or Canterbury St. Augustine's manuscripts. So he's copying images to put them in the tapestry. So he's the patron that links the place of manufacture with the place where it ends up. So he's the obvious choice. The other reason is because at every crucial stage in the tapestry's narrative, it's Odo saving the day, as here at Hastings, you know, stopping the Norman rout. No other source attributes that to Odo except the tapestry. Now, I go on about the tapestry a lot in this talk at the top because just to remind ourselves what an extraordinary source it is. We really shouldn't have a piece of embroidery nearly a millennium old. I mean, we know these things aren't exactly... they're not uncommon with the super, super elite that can afford them in the 11th century. We know other people make them because we have references in manuscript sources, in poems, to such great tapestries. What we don't have are other extant examples. We just have a few sorry-looking inches here, you know, from someone's tomb, or half a metre there. To have 70 metres of textile from the 11th century beggars belief, especially when you consider what it's been through in those later centuries. I mean, as I say, it disappears for four centuries, but they're pretty violent centuries. It disappears for the Middle Ages, effectively. So if you can imagine it surviving the war, fire, flood that you might get to destroy it, as well as, you know, mice, moths, that kind of thing. It survives the wars of religion in France when it comes close to being destroyed. It survives the French Revolution, where it's nearly cut up and used for bunting. And then after the Revolution, it is rediscovered by both the English and the French and carted off to Paris by Napoleon. And it's exhibited in Paris. There are plays put on about it in Paris. After that, it comes back to Bayeux and is exhibited like... Hang on, I'll get there. It's exhibited like that in Bayeux Town Hall. Like a giant loo roll, you could unroll it and have a look. And a couple of outraged Englishmen cut off bits to take home. They're in the V&A now. And again, it was taken back to Paris in the 20th century by the Nazis. By a more twisted logic, seen as a great Teutonic victory over the English. I should have said that's why Napoleon obviously liked it. It showed a French victory over England. The Nazis thought the same, and you can see black and white photos of Himmler and Goering admiring the Bayeux tapestry. And it survived the Paris equivalent of the Blitz, the firestorm that engulfed Paris. It was moved around from one museum cellar to the next. And so, you know, really, by all you know, statistics, I ought to be showing you Victorian etchings of this and saying, you know, and it was destroyed at this point. But luckily, thank goodness, we still have it. Now, you don't need me to tell you the story, right? If we do it in 2 minutes, and we start at the top, there is Edward the Confessor. The Bayeux Tapestry, we're not quite sure when it starts. Most scholars think 1064. But Edward the Confessor, there is, even my Latin's up to that. Look, Edward Rex, there he is, Edward the Confessor. He's been king in 1066 for 24 years, which is a long reign by 11th century standards. He dies on the 5th of January, 1066. But crucially, the famous bit, he hasn't had any children of his own. No direct heirs. And according to English sources, in his dying moments, he bequeaths the throne to his brother-in-law, Harold Godwinson. There's obviously, that's Edward looking not at all well with the crown on. And there's him touching the hands of Harold Godwinson. But Harold's right to the throne was contested, as you know, by... there's Harold getting the crown. You can see the person giving him the crown, and then he points back to the deathbed bequest as if to say that's where it was all made official. But Harold's right is contested by Duke William of Normandy, Edward's second cousin. According to Norman sources, Edward had promised the throne to William 15 years earlier. And incidentally, in this scene, look, we've got three men. If you can see my laser pointer, there's William in the middle. There's his other half-brother, Robert. Notice who's doing the listening and the nodding and who's doing the talking again.
I think we should invade. Well, that's a good idea, Odo.
Harold, being the man on the spot, is crowned. 6th of January, 1066. And so, inevitably, 8 or 9 months later... there's a right royal bust. I used to do this thing, it's much better for kids, where you say, you know, so, you know, I like a man who's his second cousin. I like. There's only one way to sort it out, you know, Harry Hill style. Fine. See, it doesn't work, that joke, does it? So that's what happens at Hastings in October 1066. And we all know how it ends. The Normans win, and Harold falls on that ridge. Don't believe what you read in the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Mail. That's where he fell. That's where the English were defeated. That's where the battle was. See my devastating review of ideas to the contrary in this month's History Today. So to medieval minds and William himself, God had judged his claim to be the better one. Now, my question this morning, as you will know if you've looked at the title, is why on earth does any of this matter? We've got a good visual source, a good story, a bloody and decisive battle, the most important, one of the most important battles in Western European history. We can admit all of that and still say, so what? You know, what? Why should we remember 1066 as that one date above all others? Why is it important that William won and Harold lost? After all, William himself, when he's crowned on Christmas Day 1066, the official line from William and the Normans is nothing has changed. You know, nothing to see here. You can go on having your laws and customs just as they had been before the conquest. This is another extraordinary document. It's an original writ, a royal letter issued within weeks, if not days, of William's coronation on Christmas Day 1066. And you can see there, I don't know if I can get the laser pointer that far, but it starts off, William King, Greek William Biscuit. My Anglo-Saxon is non-existent, but it essentially says, I'm assured, that the citizens of London can have their laws and customs just as they had been in the time of good King Edward. But despite these kind of professed intentions, both in William's coronation oath and in the writs he's sending out at the top of his reign, huge, sweeping, seismic change follows immediately on from the Battle of Hastings. And I think there are all kinds of reasons, obviously, but you can sort of boil it down to two essentials. In the first place, William has an army of 7,000 men at his back. And they are a mercenary army, but by and large, they are hungry for reward in the form of land. Some of them want the shiny stuff and just go back to Normandy, but a lot of them have been promised land. Now, in this respect, the Normans differ considerably to previous generations of invaders, i.e. the Vikings. The Vikings, it's true, a few of them stayed in Canute's reign, but the majority of them were content to take the Danegeld, to take the shiny stuff, to take the plunder, and go home, back to Scandinavia. And if you look at anywhere over Scandinavia, you can find runestones erected, people saying things like, I, Thorkell, the skull crusher, came with Canute and took Danegeld and put up this runestone. So that's one difference. And as a consequence, William is dispossessing Englishmen from the first, dead Englishmen in the first instance, because a lot of people have died at Hastings. So he's able to say, well, you can have Gospatric's land, and that's a straightforward transfer. The difficulty is that, of course, those dead Englishmen who William is dispossessing have sons or brothers or uncles whose expectations of inheritance are thereby dashed. So there are a lot of disappointed, angry Englishmen who are left alive. And that's point one, dispossession from the first. Second point is precisely those angry, disaffected Englishmen, because the second point is that William was very lenient after the Battle of Hastings. You don't tend to think of the Normans as lenient. This is an idea I've been working up or trying to sort of disseminate for some time. They were very bloody in their warfare, like all 11th century warriors, but after the battle they spared their opponents. In this respect, of course, they differ hugely from the Vikings who'd come before, and the English. King Canute, we think of as a comical character, famous for the waves, but he marked his accession by sort of chopping off the heads of all the survivors. So this combination, on the one hand, of disinheritance and leniency, encourages the English to rebel for the first 4 or 5 years after 1066. You have some minor rebellions in 1067, when William goes back to Normandy. Then you have, they start to get more serious with each passing year. So in 1068, the start of the year, the West Country goes up. You have a big rising in the Midlands, which misfires, and then a rising here in the north, again, which misfires. And then two much more serious risings in 1069 in the north. The first one, which sort of fizzles out here in York, and another one, which in the summer-winter of 1069, which is supported by a Danish invasion. And this is a real kind of make-or-break time for William and the Norman conquest. It's very easy to sort of forget that we know that the Norman conquest is permanent and it's the last time England was invaded, etc., successfully. But William doesn't know that at the time, and William sees the conquest being a flash in the pan at this point, as do the English. We have the chronicle descriptions of them sort of laughing and rejoicing and marching on York and taking York and thinking they were going to conquer the whole country. So William's response inevitably is fire and sword, repression. Exeter is put down, besieged. The Midlands, castles being built. Famously in the north, the harrying of the north, you know, the deliberate destruction because you can't hold it, of all points north of the Humber. Crops torched, animals slaughtered, which means that whether you're killing people deliberately or not, they are going to starve in the winter that follows. And so you have this vicious cycle from the sort of 1067 onwards of more rebellion leading to repression, leading to more disinheritance, leading to more rebellion, leading to more, etc., etc. And so by the time you get to the end of William's reign, he dies in 1087, but in 1086 he compiles the famous Doomsday Book, seen there before it was rebound in the 1980s. That's as it was originally, two volumes, Great Doomsday and Little Doomsday. By the time you get to the Doomsday Book, England has been completely transformed. Now, depending on which expert you ask, and I've asked a lot of them, there are either 500 or 1,000 tenants-in-chief in Doomsday Book, named in Doomsday Book, i.e. men who hold their land directly from the king. So by and large, you know, the big kahunas. And if we go with a minimum estimate of 500 great men in Doomsday, only 13 names, only 13 of those 500 are Englishmen. And their lands are pretty small. They're small fry. So the top tier of the aristocracy completely replaced. Doomsday is only concerned with one other tenurial level, the people who hold their lands from those tenants, i.e. the king's sub-tenants. And it names about 7,000 or 8,000 additional names. Again, even down at that secondary level, 90% of the names are Norman newcomers or continental newcomers, only 10% Englishmen. So even if you define the aristocracy very broadly as the top 9 or 10,000 people, it's been completely swept away, or almost completely swept away and replaced. And that's not just true of the lay aristocracy. It's true of the ecclesiastical hierarchy as well. 11th century England has 15 bishoprics, i.e. 15 bishops. And by the time you get to 1086 as well, only one of those bishops is an Englishman, the wily and tenacious Wulfstan of Worcester. Same true of the great abbots as well. If you think of any great abbey, Malmesbury, Tewkesbury, Ely, Peterborough, etc., all those abbots are replaced with continental newcomers. So we have swift and comprehensive change at the top of English society. And I think this has far-reaching implications. I'm not alone in saying this, but there are other people that would say that nothing changes but the haircuts, you know, the continuists. And I think it's much more than that. And that's what I want to look at in the whatever time I have remaining to me, about 25 minutes. And so the first theme I want to look at is warfare. Let's have a look, see if I've got a pick. Okay, so back to that slide. Wherever I've looked at Anglo-Saxon warfare in the 11th century, prior to the conquest, it seems to me to have very strong affinities with Scandinavian warfare. And this is an obvious example seen at Hastings. The Normans there famously riding into battle and the English standing on foot. Now, that's not the whole story. That's only a bit of the story because the Normans brought lots of infantry with them. But the significant point is the Normans did use cavalry and the English preferred not to. The English fought on foot in the sort of Scandinavian fashion with their shield wall. And elsewhere where you look at Anglo-Saxon society or warfare before the conquest, it seems to me to have that strong affinity. It's all about ships, for example. Top of Edward the Confessor's reign, we don't think of Edward the Confessor as a warrior king, we think of him as a sort of pious milksop. But if you look at what he's doing in the 1040s, he's sailing out from Sandwich in Kent every year with a navy raised to deter Viking invasion. So it's all about ships. When he starts his reign, he is appeased by his notorious father-in-law, Earl Godwin, by being given a great gilded warship. And there is a poem that survives describing it, and it's all about, you know, the guys with the helmets and the gold torques, and it has a very Norse flavour to it. When you look at the word used to describe a force in Anglo-Saxon England, it's very difficult to work out from that word whether they are talking about a naval force or a land-based force. I think I've made my point. By contrast, when you look at Normandy, it's all about horses, it's all about land-based warfare, and it's all about castles. Now, I'm afraid I don't have time to have a sort of a fight with anybody in the audience about this, so you just have to take it from me now and argue with me afterwards. The English did not have castles before 1066, okay? This is an argument that really ought to be put to bed by now. There was an attempt in the 1960s to say, well, surely the English had burhs and burgheats, and they were almost like castles. No, they weren't, okay? Every society that has lordship can have, you know, says, well, I want to defend my homestead, I want a wall around the outside, I want a palisade, but they are not built on this kind of scale. This is a castle, properly speaking, built in the 1030s or 1040s near Dieppe, called Arc. So it's built during the boyhood of William the Conqueror. And it's built by his uncle, helpfully called William. It's fantastic in a world without surnames, when first names are so popular. So it makes it a challenge to the writer. So William besieges his uncle William here when they fall out in circa 1050. And it takes William, a fantastic sort of exponent of siege warfare that he is, a good 6 months or more to drive his uncle out. Now this is really, I think, where you can prove that the English did not have castles, because it's in the politics, the proof. If you look at pre-conquest England, the answer is, if there's a castle, show me a place that's besieged. When politics breaks down in England, as it does frequently in the 1030s and 1040s and 1050s, the great earls run away. They go into exile. The Godwins, the earls of Mercia, they flee to Ireland, they flee to Flanders, and what do? They raise fleets. They don't hole up in Bosham or Norwich or Northampton and sort of say, bring it on, which is what they do in on the continent. And I can go on about this. There's the Normans getting off the boat at Hastings in 1066. What's the first thing they do? Build a castle. Why? Because the English didn't have castles. I think you see where I'm going with this. And they're building them in this distinctive style, which you'll all know from your own school days. What's that? A mot. Well done, yes. A mot and bailey. There are two mots within 10 minutes walk of here. A very famous one, Clifford's Tower, and a very, very sadly neglected one, all covered in trees, that I looked at. It's literally 2 minutes walk down the road, the Bale Hill. Both built by the Normans in 1068-1069. Now, that's what a mot looked like in the 11th century. I think it's nice to have a slide like that because, you know, today, mot and baileys are nice places to take the kids on a bank holiday weekend, all covered in grass. But back then, they were instruments of repression. You know, you had to round up hundreds of Anglo-Saxons and say, dig, to build that kind of thing. You had to fell hectares and hectares of trees in order to get all the timber to make the palisade and the tower. And they were a real blight on the landscape, you know. You can see why the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle was weeping. They built castles far and wide throughout the land. This is for 1067. They built castles far and wide throughout the land, suppressing the unhappy people. And if you think of any famous castle, Windsor, Warwick, York, both of them, Norwich, Winchester, Newcastle, Colchester, the Tower of London, Ludlow, etc., etc. They were all established like this as weapons of conquest within years, if not, well, within the first few years of the Norman conquest. A conservative estimate suggests that we're looking at about 500 in the first generation after the conquest. We've certainly got 1,000 or so earthwork sites like this in England and Wales. Now, let's move on. I don't know whether you would consider that architecture, perhaps not, but at some of these castles we do definitely have architecture. Now, I give out points at this stage. For 10 points, does anyone know what that is? Chepstow, well done. Chepstow Castle on the River Wye there. This great tower, once attributed to one of William's lieutenants, William Fitzosborne, but latterly redated by the boffins at Cadw, and we're now told it's post-1075, i.e. it's a royal building, which certainly fits with the architecture and fits with the politics. You know, this is the western fringe of William's kingdom. He's sort of extending his lordship, his overlordship over these Welsh princes, and building a hall in which to receive them, perhaps in which to receive tribute. So a great stone tower there from perhaps 1075 onwards. For 5 points, Colchester. Yes, getting easier, isn't it? Hence the points going down. Colchester. You know, people tend to say, that was taller originally. We now think that it was perhaps never any higher than that, based on antiquarian drawings. But massive, huge at base, the biggest of all Norman great towers at base, 110 feet by 150 feet, because they were building on the foundations of an old Roman temple. And for no points, the tower, which obviously has strong affinities with Colchester. Look at that projecting apsidal chapel there, perhaps the same designer. But here, I think I can just let the picture speak. This is a huge, huge building. I walked around it. I live near Dover in Kent, and I'm there a lot. With my small children, but I walked around the tower on Wednesday this week, and it's huge, absolutely huge. And you know, we tend to we call these buildings Romanesque, but the Romans had nothing on this in Britain, you know, prior to the conquest. Nothing this tall, certainly. So this is secular building of a kind that's never been seen before in Britain. And of course, it's not just secular building. The Normans, when it comes, you can only truly appreciate the scale of the architectural revolution when you look at churches. Now, this is where I'm sort of rude about the Anglo-Saxons, so apologies. I don't know what your reaction... This is a piece of Anglo-Saxon ecclesiastical architecture from the early 11th century. I mislabeled it in the pictures in the book. It's Earls Barton in Northamptonshire, and I got it confused with Barton on Humber in Lincolnshire, which has a very similar looking 11th century church, so it's corrected in the paperback. Anyway, my reaction to this is, whilst I like it, I think it's sort of slightly gauche, somewhat rustic. My general sort of, I suppose, impression is, or thought is, I could do that. You know, it looks like a... looks like a church I've built, or a well-iced cake or something. Whereas, if you compare that early 11th century English church architecture, which is what's going on in the first half of the 11th century in Normandy, this is Jumièges Abbey on the River Seine, you can see Romanesque has arrived. This is what you think of as a great medieval abbey. We've all of a sudden got that precision of line, 3D, effectively. We've got blind arcading, arches, columns, etc. Symmetry has arrived. The Normans didn't invent it, but boy, did they go for it in a big way from about 1020 onwards, rebuilding all their churches and abbeys. And, of course, that's what they do after the conquest, beginning with St. Augustine's Canterbury. No, it's not St. Augustine's, Christchurch Canterbury. Well, both of them, actually, in 1070. The new Archbishop of Canterbury, Lanfranc, rebuilds Canterbury. And then almost one year, you know, year after year after that, throughout the 1070s and 1080s, the cathedrals being ripped down and replaced. I said there were 15 of them. By the time you get to William's death in 1087, 9 of the 15 have been ripped down and have been rebuilt or are being rebuilt. And by the time you get to the death of his son, Henry I, in 1135, they've all been done. All 15 cathedrals ripped down and replaced. And that's true of all the great abbeys as well, like the ones I've mentioned, Malmesbury, Tewkesbury, St. Albans, all replaced. And the scale of these buildings is massive compared to what had gone before. I can't remember the exact measurements. I'm not that retentive. But this one's, Jumièges, it's about, I think, the nave is about 140 feet. And if you compare nave lengths, without exception, you can see they go up sort of 10 feet, 5 feet, 15 feet from one to the next. And it strikes me as like sort of 20th century bridge building. You know, people saying, how long is Lincoln again? Says the Bishop of, you know, right, okay, right, then this one, my one, will be 20 feet longer, obviously. And so you see it going up, so they're reaching sort of 200, 210 feet by the late 1070s. And then we have Winchester. Winchester, begun in 1079, the biggest of them all. Its nave, an astonishing 266 feet long. This is obviously a much later nave. We have the Norman Tower, the crossing, which is early 12th century, the nave, which is replaced in the later Middle Ages. But its footprint is original. And one reason I like this slide as well is because you can see the outline of the old Anglo-Saxon minster, the old minster at Winchester, and the whole church doesn't even extend as far as the crossing of the Norman church. There is, in fact, only... Well, I would say it's the biggest church in Britain at this time. It's also the biggest church in Northern Europe. Even the cathedrals being built by the Holy Roman Emperor at Spire and Mainz aren't as big as Winchester. There's only one church in Christendom which is bigger, and that's St. Peter's in Rome itself. So, the Normans are building on a scale which compares, outclasses the emperors of the present, and is on a par with the emperors of old. So this is the message that William the Conqueror is sending out, building in Winchester, of course, the ancient capital of Wessex. He wants to be perceived as on a par with these other rulers. Now, so we've talked about warfare, we've talked about architecture. The last thing I want to talk about, if we have time, is attitudes. Not just attitudes towards warfare and architecture, but attitudes towards life itself. And this is, again, this is where I started doing this talk. I started talking about feudalism, and which is, you know, the F word. You're really not allowed to use that word anymore. I don't know if that's filtered down this far, but say that in sort of All Souls medieval seminar and fainting fits amongst the assembled dons. The reason being, feudalism is a very dated ism. We have the word feudal sort of coined in the 16th, 17th centuries, and then we have the ism put on the end in the early 19th century. So it's very old, and it means all things to all men. You know, if you ask, particularly if you ask a French scholar what they mean by what they expect of feudalism, they say, well, it's the king at the top and the lords underneath and then the peasants at the bottom. Now, that describes any society in Western Europe from about the 9th century through to the 16th. What English scholars tend to assume you mean if you say feudalism, as they say, ah, well, you mean something after 1066, land held in return for military service and a fixed quota, you know, given out by the... It's very specific and technical. Now, we can sort of sweep all that to one side and say, I think whether the Normans introduced feudalism or not, therefore a kind of a bit of a red herring. What the Normans did do, I think is unquestionable, is introduce a more exacting form of lordship. You can see it in the complaints in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle about rents being ratcheted up. You can see it in Doomsday Book, where you can see the figures for that, and also occasionally lines like "He now holds his hands in, lands in heaviness and misery." So I think, as you would expect with a colonial society, for that's what we're dealing with after 1066, with a new governing class interested in extracting the wealth from a new underclass, just like the British in India, we are seeing a more intense form of lordship. Now, I say all that by way of sort of prelude to saying that means if you're a freeman in England, your life probably becomes a lot worse after the conquest. But not everyone in pre-conquest England, of course, was free. There's a good percentage of the population, and again, depending on which scholars you ask, at least 10% and possibly as much as 30% of the population were slaves. I've got a picture here of a man, an 11th century Englishman, pushing a plough, or guiding a plough, and a lot of ploughmen were slaves. Now, to be a slave was far worse than being a post-conquest peasant. After the conquest, peasants had all kinds of restrictions in the Middle Ages placed on their movement, on who they could marry, etc. But they weren't considered things. They weren't considered to be bestial. They weren't considered to be human chattels. They couldn't be branded, castrated, or even killed, as they could be before the conquest, and there was nothing they could do. And sold as well, famously, you know, because slaves are bought and sold like things. Which is all true of slavery before the conquest. We've said there were lots of them. Now, in Normandy, by contrast, before the conquest, once upon a time they had slaves. The Normans, you'll all know, were originally Norsemen, Vikings, who had settled in northern France. And the Vikings are slave traders par excellence throughout the whole of the Middle Ages. But the Normans, by around the year 1000, had given up on slavery. Rouen, which used to be a great international slave trading centre, the last references we hear to a slave market there are around the turn of the millennium. We have no more references at all to slavery after the 1020s. And this seems to be nothing less than a moral shift. There's, again, our arguments have been put forward to do with a rise of a monetary economy or a Christian church saying you shouldn't treat these people that way. Church has no problem with slavery. Back as well, you know, the church, only you have to look at the Bible and say, that's okay, the slaves are in the Bible. You know, so it's nothing to do with the church per se, though maybe individual churchmen saying you shouldn't treat people this way. And accordingly, we see a sharp decline in slavery in England after the conquest, where you can measure it in Doomsday Book, the number of slaves drops by 25%. And we know there was a great slave trade operated out of Bristol in the 11th century, as there was in later centuries, of course, but they had the first bite of the cherry, the Bristolians, in the 11th century, exporting English slaves to Ireland. That is wound up by William the Conqueror at the instance of Lanfranc, his moral tutor. We have a church council, true, that condemns slavery as late as 1102 in England, but, significantly, it's the last church council that condemns slavery in England in 1102. And by the time you get to the 1120s, 1130s, slavery is clearly a thing of the past. Where's my quote? "In this respect," said the monk Lawrence of Durham, "the English found foreigners treated them better than they had treated themselves." And this is true as well in terms of another important respect, which is chivalry. I don't think I've got a picture for chivalry, so hard to sum up with a picture. Gove is right. Chivalry, nothing to do with later perversions like saying, oh, you shoot first, you know, I insist. Much more practical in the 11th century, it's essentially not killing people, something I've touched on already, not killing people when they're on their knees begging for mercy.
William?
I mean, don't get me wrong here. Please do not get me wrong. William the Conqueror and the Normans are brutal, savage when they prosecute their warfare, witness the harrying of the North, you know. But this is the significant difference. When people surrender to William the Conqueror, the most common response in after the conquest is he sells them back their lands in exchange for a promise of fidelity. This is not something that previous conquerors or previous English kings had done. They had lopped people's heads off. If you look at the bloody purges during the reign of Ethelred the Unready, or at the throughout Canute's reign, if you look at the way Earl Godwin executes Edward's brother Alfred, if you look at the way Tostig Godwinson executes his political rivals in Northumbria, even when they're under safe conduct, you can see that political killing is par for the course in pre-conquest England right up to 1066 itself. But this all changes after the conquest because the Normans had this new attitude. No man dared slay another, says the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, talking about William, and this is William's obituary, no matter what evil he might have done him. There's only one Englishman of political consequence after the conquest who's deliberately done in, and that's Waltheof, Earl of Northumbria. He probably had it coming, because he was perfectly happy to do in his own opponents. 1074, he chops all the heads off his opponents when they're sitting down to dinner in Setrington, not far from here. And he's said to be judged by the laws of the English. But he is the last Englishman to be executed, last English Earl, rather, to be executed, 1076, until 1306, 230 years later. So the conquest, in other words, ushers in nearly 2.5 centuries of chivalrous restraint when it comes to the way you deal with your aristocratic enemies. And this, sort of as a coda to this slavery and chivalry section, these new attitudes towards human life have massive knock-on effects with respect to the rest of the British Isles, because they take root very quickly in England. If you remove the entire ruling class down to a very low level, several thousand people, then those ideas become the norm. And you can find English people, or half English, half Norman writers, by the 1120s, looking at their Celtic neighbours with a fresh and critical eye. William of Malmesbury in particular is pioneering in this respect. He starts looking at the Welsh and the Scots and saying, these people are barbarians. Because, you know, they do things the old way, the ways that we don't do them anymore. They keep coming into Hereford and burning the cathedral to the ground and leading off the women and children in chains to be sold, you know. So they're not playing by the new rules. And this means that the English can at that point start to develop this critical, hostile stereotype of the Celt as barbarian, which informs the English conquests in the rest of the British Isles throughout the rest of the Middle Ages and beyond. See my Edward I, Great and Terrible King, available in the foyer. Now, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm running out of time, and also that I sound like I'm on this sort of rostrum saying, the Normans, they're great. And I'm really not. That's not my intention. I say this at the top of the book, and I'm going to say at the end of this talk, I find the Normans hugely dislikable. Okay, like all conquerors, they are supremely pleased with themselves. In this respect, I agree with Orderic Vitalis. He really lays into them. I can't remember what he says, but they're arrogant, warlike. They're holier than thou as well, which must have been really irritating. But I don't like the English either. You know, they're not me either. I just finished a talk on this, if anyone's looking for an article to publish, that I gave at the Tower earlier this week. You know, this idea that we should identify with the Anglo-Saxons as us. You know, I don't know what my genealogy is back as far as 1066. I mean, if you do, well done, you know. But to sort of start saying, well, they're my ethnic group, you know, I think that's extremely dodgy. Just type the word English, spelt with a C on the end, into Google and see where you end up. But nevertheless, you know, I don't like the English with their political killing and their slavery and their, you know, human chattels and their bling and their tattoos, etc. But I think it's important to end on what was lost as a result of the conquest. I've touched upon this as well. Artistic treasures. The English were big into sort of their metalwork, their silverware. That's all taken away as plunder, gifts in William of Poitiers to Normandy, or melted down to pay mercenaries. You know, the English monasteries are plundered repeatedly to pay for those troops. And the churches themselves. I mean, I've showed you a couple of great Romanesque churches, but you won't find a single piece of standing Anglo-Saxon masonry at any of those abbeys or cathedrals today, because they pulled them all down. And that is, again, perhaps tatty, old, centuries old, out of date as those churches were, they had been put up in some stages by the saints they were named after, you know, in the 7th century. "We wretches are destroying the work of the saints," wept Wulfstan of Worcester as they ripped the roof from his cathedral in 1084, "thinking in our insolent pride we are improving them." And there are countless stories that emerge in the 12th century at every single sort of monastic history of insensitive Norman abbots who turned up in the 1070s or 1080s and said, "Well, who's this Saint Jan's? Why, I can't even say his name. Right, get rid of him." Chucking the bones out the door, you know, testing the relics by fire. So it wasn't good for Anglo-Norman relations in the cloister. Though amusingly, in all those stories, there's a common topos, which is the abbot either then goes to dinner, the new Norman abbot, and chokes on a bone, or in more scurrilous ones, you know, falls down the cludgy and drowns, thus demonstrating the awesome power of St. Wulfsig, or whoever it happens to be he's insulted. But, so that's another point. Another point is the abandonment of written English. We've seen this already, William issuing a writ at the top of his reign. But the point I didn't make was he's writing to the English in the vernacular. Now, that's a tradition that goes right back to Alfred, and it's unique in Western Europe. People say, well, what about the Irish monks? They wrote in Gaelic. Yes, writing monastic chronicles is one thing, but to have a document-driven government, which is what the English had the powerful English state from the 10th century, issuing orders in the language that people spoke was unique. Everywhere else in Europe used Latin. The Normans keep that going for the first few years, but then after the harrying of the north, the year 1070, they switch to Latin. Now, you can see this written up as a very cold cultural attack, you know, almost a sort of a Nazi-style move of saying, you know, you English with your English, we'll have Latin, you know, we'll have order. But I think you can view it as a pragmatic move as well. You know, if you've just replaced all the bishops and the abbots and the sheriffs and they're all Norman, what's the point of writing to them in Old English? You know, you've got to get Wulfsig, come back, you know. What does this say? Whereas, so it can be regarded as a practical move, but I think the English at the time, we know from what they said that they did regard it as a cultural attack. There's a fragment of a 12th century manuscript at Worcester in Old English. "Now that teaching is forsaken and the folk are lost. Now there is another people that teaches our folk and many of our teachers are damned." Nothing changes. "And our folk with them." And lastly, and obviously, massive loss of human life. Hastings, we will never know, don't believe what you read in your little Henry's histories, we'll never know the precise numbers on each side, several thousand. We'll never know, therefore, the precise body count, but several thousand, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people dead. And the Englishmen that survived that experience, you know, they've got the rebellions that follow, tens of thousands of souls swept away. And in the case of the harrying of the north, the chroniclers, Alderic Vitalis, uses a number 100,000, which you always taught as a medievalist to take with a pinch of salt. A monk looking out the window goes, 20, 30, 40, 40, 40 a lot, 100,000. But in this case, it seems he may be pretty close to the truth, because the experts who've crunched the numbers on Doomsday Book, John Palmer in particular, sees an order of that magnitude, a six-figure number, for the drop in population in Yorkshire alone. So massive, massive loss of human life. The English did not see the Normans as agents of civilising change. "In their unparalleled savagery," wrote Henry of Huntingdon in the early 12th century, "they surpassed all other peoples. They arrogantly abused their authority," said Alderic Vitalis, "mercilessly slaughtering the native people like the scourge of God smiting them for their sins." Right, I'm going to stop there and give you that to look at. If you want to contact me, because I do live by my pen and I do tours and talks at a reasonable rate. And take questions from the floor, I guess.